my first draft, like every other writer's first draft, was terrible. It was garbage. And there were 10th
it's
drafts.
It's easy to say that now.
It is. Oh, it's a lot easier to say that now. In the moment, I wanted to put that thing on Barnes & Noble's immediately, but it doesn't really work like that.
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest is Nigerian-American author Shola Bimi, author of the novel They Were Chosen. It's a book that chronicles the lives of a group of college co-eds and sometimes their problematic point of view.
A lot of people don't realize that, like, jokes are a really good way to get to know certain people, or at least the person who's telling them. You know, you'll have people who tell jokes about themselves. You'll have people who crack jokes about women. So I felt like humor would be a great vehicle for people to gradually get to know the person that they're dealing with.
Shola's novel is told through the voices of both his male and female protagonists, a perspective he says he would not have gotten right had he not been checked by the women in his life. He explains how he learned to write women with depth and nuance using the Bechdel test. Plus, the reason he said blowing his publishing deadlines only made him a better writer. And how his fifth grade teacher inspired him to pick up the pen in the first place. That and more is ahead when Black and Published continues. So let's just jump in and get started. Shola, awesome. When did you know that you were a writer?
I knew that I was a writer shortly after my 9th birthday, when I had written a memoir in the 5th grade about my first time going to Coney Island. My English teacher had us do an assignment about a family memory. And at the time, I had but so many, right? I was 9 years old, and I couldn't shake the memory of the 2-hour-long train ride from Jamaica, Queens, all the way to Coney Island in Brooklyn, the amusement park, the beach, the boardwalk. I don't remember exactly how I wrote about it at this point, but my fifth grade teacher felt like it really stood out, and she pulled me to the side and really started to encourage me to take writing a bit more seriously.
Just the fact that you say you wrote a memoir at 9, I love it. What was it about writing at that age and going forward that really kept you going?
It was therapeutic. So the way my fifth grade teacher kind of tricked me into sticking with writing, because honestly, I was like, this is a 1-page, 2-page assignment. Let me just reflect and hand it in. But I stuck with writing because I would get into fights. At the time, I had transitioned from private school to public school. There was a lot of slang I didn't know. The way I dressed wasn't really up to par with the way a lot of other kids dressed. And I didn't really like getting bullied. So I got into a lot of fights. And my fifth grade teacher got me a spare notebook and had me utilize it as a journal. So she wanted me to write in it whenever I got upset and felt like getting into any fights or situations. And I mean, it worked sometimes. Most of the time it didn't work, but it gave me an excuse to keep writing outside of like the academic requirement space that I had become familiar with it in.
Yeah, you in your acknowledgments for your novel, They Were Chosen, you thank your teacher and talk about the journals that you wrote in, as well as discussing that you started your novel in 2014, when you were a junior in college, with the thought that you were going to write it the first semester and publish it the second semester, which turned out to be a 7-year journey in and of itself. So what made you decide that you wanted to write a novel by that point in your life?
So I had my first thought about writing a novel when I was a senior in high school. I felt like writing a novel about myself at first, because I just thought I had a lot to say. I was 17. I felt like my life was like the most important thing in the whole wide world and everyone needed to know about it, you know? So, and I felt like I could do it. And I thought it would be really dope to be able to walk around and say, hey, not only am I a good writer, but I put out a body of work. But during college, I did end up taking a few creative writing courses. I learned more about the craft. Ultimately learned, too, that, you know, unless you're like Will Smith or like Oprah Winfrey or someone notable, 9 times out of 10, there's but so many people who want to read about your life if they don't already know you as a notable figure. So that put me in a position to find inspiration in just normal things that myself and other people were experiencing in the Black community, and to write something that wasn't necessarily about me, but more so relatable for a lot of people.
And your novel is set in Jamaica, Queens. You set it on a college campus, this HBCU, and kind of talk about the things that were happening at the time, most notably the social justice movements with Black Lives Matter around the deaths of Eric Garner and Michael Brown, as well as including some other elements with Massage Noir. Why was it those topics that stood out to you the most? And why did you want to combine them? Usually people write about social justice or they write about Massage Noir, but you decided to do both.
I felt like writing those subjects together because throughout my latter high school experience and for a majority of my college experience, I was seeing how a lot of those different realities weren't occurring in a vacuum. And one thing that really stood out to me in college was that there were and are still to this day certain issues that affect the Black community that also divide people within the Black community. Sexual harassment is like a big one where I literally just finished watching the Mike docu-series on Hulu, and they were talking about his case in the early 90s. And then you had people, just all sorts of civil rights leaders using their platforms to denounce this young lady who was clearly a victim. And you had folks in the Black community saying, this is a ploy of the white man and the system to tear this man down. And then you had folks in the same community saying, no, like, this was wrong. Like, she is a victim. And it made a lot of sense for me to explore that kind of like phenomena in my story, because I think police brutality is one of those issues where almost every progressive minded Black person I've met believes that police brutality is a thing and that it's wrong. But we don't see that level of consistency with a number of other issues that are equally as important and equally as damaging in the Black community. So it was hard for me to attach myself to one of those issues without touching on the others, because I was writing this book during a time where I was noticing that divide in attention and that divide in belief around issues that are actually real and issues that are not issues.
Thank you for explaining that, because we're going to get to the divisiveness of the issues in your novel in a second, because there were some parts that I guess were real heavy on the Massage Noir, especially from one particular character. And I was like, ooh, I want to shake this person right now. It read very real. And the commentary and the conversations within the text explores all of that with some nuance and some complexity, but also just like blanket statements and generalizations that were like, it's very uncomfortable. Yeah. So in discussing what sparked your interest and what made you want to write, we also discussed just previously that you started in 2014, but your novel was published in 2021. So talk about what your self-publishing process was like and why it took so long.
Yeah, so what's funny is I really meant to publish in December of 2021, but around that time, I actually started a pre-sale, and the pre-sale process, going back to your question, ended up being a little longer than I anticipated. So I officially released the book in April of 2022. But the process was challenging. It required me, one, to be consistent and to develop a lot of discipline. Writing high quality work, and it's not necessarily to pat myself on the back, but just writing anything with the intentions of sharing it with people and hopefully receiving positive feedback, I think it takes a lot of discipline, because my first draft, like every other writer's first draft, was terrible. It was garbage. And there were 10th drafts.
It's easy to say that now.
It is. Oh, it's a lot easier to say that now. In the moment, I wanted to put that thing on Barnes & Noble's immediately. But it doesn't really work like that. And I had to develop discipline to keep redrafting, and then being humble enough to admit that I can't look at it with my own eyes and expect it to be the best it could be. So then seeking out a professional editor to apply that level of professionalism and expertise, relying on mentors and really leaning heavily on Black women in my life to check me on my male gaze and my assumptions on how women exist in fiction and how women exist in the world. This was a very, I think the process, as technical as publishing is, for me personally, as a Black man writing a book centering around the experiences of a Black man and a Black woman and trying to create equity between those two characters to the best of my ability, this was a very thought-provoking and educational experience.
So what did you learn then, as it being an educational experience, about publishing, even in self-publishing your own work and establishing your own imprint with Vision Speaks Press, that you didn't know before?
The first thing I learned was that timelines are not as important as the quality of the work. I set so many deadlines. I cannot count how many deadlines I set and missed and beat myself up about, but I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for all the times that I missed those deadlines because it wasn't ready. It wasn't ready. Great things take time. I've learned so much about my own biases. I've learned things like the Bechdel test, which essentially they went through a bunch of American films to see how many scenes one included a woman in the scene. And in that scene, is this woman talking about a man? So essentially, you have all these films where these producers and directors and screenwriters are writing female characters, but these female characters have no depth. They have no nuance because these directors and, well, writers really weren't doing their due diligence to really unpack as much humanity as they could in those female characters. That's one of several things I learned in this process, was just how easy it is to miss the opportunity to write a very full female character.
So then with that said, let's get to the reading of your novel. Do you have a copy of it with you?
I do.
Black and Published family, it's time for the reading. They Were Chosen follows Jide Jermaine Asheori and Kendra Gaskins on the fictional HBCU campus of Brookville College. Like most 20-somethings, the two are more interested in the next party or probate show, until one party gets a little too crazy and leaves them questioning themselves and their circle of friends as they wonder what they're going to do to make things right. Here's Shola.
So in this chapter, we get to revisit a moment in Jermaine's childhood where he's at home watching TV. His mom and dad are still together, and he's reminiscing on what it means to be a Black child as much as it is to be a Nigerian child. Pop forced PBS's educational shows on me like they'd bless him with a commission for each one I pretended to enjoy. Cyber Chase was the only one I really liked. The villains and violence in each episode made the math problems interesting. Among me, he whispered in his Nigerian accent once, "I love seeing you watch this. Math is so important, especially if you want to be a doctor." "Daddy," I said, "can I watch Toonami too?" "Damien and Ramik get to watch Toonami." Pop sighed. "Damien, Ramik, come on. You can't compare yourself to boys with those names. Most Black boys are bastards. They don't know their fathers. That's how they wind up wearing do-rags, sagging their pants, poor English. You're not like them. You're an African, a Nigerian." Pop swore Nigerians knew the real struggle and were the highest quality of human beings on the planet. Only Nigerians could go without electricity for days and still troop it for miles in dry heat to fill their buckets with water from a well. They could go through all of that and still be the smartest in their classes. while black Akatas in America joined gangs and off each other for Jordans. Ma being Jamaican made me sort of black, but Pop's folks ate pounded yam and pepper soup drenched meat with their hands. Sometimes the men and his family barked at each other in broken pigeon over televised soccer matches. Half of my DNA inherited that, and the second graders in my school knew it. I was still African enough to be a booty scratcher.
Thank you. In crafting the characters of Jermaine or Jide and Kendra, you mentioned that you wanted to have parity between the two and make sure that your female lead protagonists also had depth of character. Who did you draw on for inspiration to create these two people and make them seem as real as they were?
I drew inspiration from real Black women that I've met in my personal life. And I didn't necessarily duplicate women that I know, but really just listening more actively in conversations, paying attention to body language, paying attention to the ways that different, because no group of people are a monolith. Like Black women aren't a monolith. I also leaned a lot on depictions of Black women in the media, positive ones. I really have to give a lot of credit to shows like Girlfriends, Insecure, a few shows that carefully examine the experiences of Black women amongst themselves and then amongst other people that don't necessarily identify as Black women. And I drew a lot of inspiration from that as well. So media helped me a lot. Interactions with friends helped me a lot. Also getting checked helped me a lot. Sharing samples. And then there's a scene where Kendra and her friends are getting ready for a party. And I remember the first time I wrote that scene, and it was just very, I wrote it as though it was a group of guys getting ready for a party, like just kind of standing around, like texting. And this was as far back as 2018 or 2017. I had a friend of mine read it, and I had a couple friends read it. And one of them was just like, you know, like girls like get naked and like they're like really comfortable around each other when they get dressed. Like they're not like guys, like they don't just sit and just be on their phones the whole time. Like girls that are comfortable with each other for the most part are very shameless about like sharing shoes and like certain things like that. And just those little nuances that I probably would have never discovered if I hadn't been checked or given any
information. I read that scene, but like when she starts twerking and she's still naked, I'm like, at that point, her homegirl probably should have told her to put on some clothes. But I was like, I was with you. But I appreciate you saying that there were people that were reading your work as you were going through to help you kind of make these characters seem more real. Because I was going to ask you, how did you overcome, you know, what you wanted to write and what you thought was accurate to what you actually got down on the page? There's also a subtlety to some of the things that are happening in the background, like the references to Amadou Diallo and Eric Garner in the beginning are very, very subtle, as well as, you know, the experience of what it is to be a young Black man driving while Black, getting out of high school and being roughed up by police, especially during New York's era of stop and frisk. In sharing those experiences, what do you want readers to take away from that part of the book? Because that's not all that you touch on.
I would hope that the readers who pick up on those subtleties can understand that there are interactions that occur between police and Black individuals that do result in death. But I also want readers to understand that simultaneously, there are a lot of experiences that young Black individuals experience, not only at the hands of police, but just on a day-to-day basis around racism and discrimination that have a negative impact on the way individuals feel, how safe people feel, and their peace of mind. And these situations don't necessarily result in death, but that doesn't make them any less important.
And so we talked about earlier, just in the writing of the novel, that you include both social justice and misogynoir, and the different standards that exist when it comes to the outrage and the protest and the unity that comes behind movements like Black Lives Matter when we're protesting Black death at the hands of vigilantes or police. But that same set of outrage does not exist when it comes to matters of sexual assault and violence against women and Black women especially. Why was that so important for you to surface in this novel as a man? Because normally some Black men say, you know, well, that's a woman's issue, and then they leave it there. But it's always Black women who are taking up after a Black man is killed by police or a vigilante. So why was that important for you to include and add your voice into the mix as an ally and a show of support through your character, Kendra?
When I was 19 years old, and this was in 2013, as a psychology major at Binghamton University, I pursued an internship at a small clinic that was then known at the time as the Interpersonal Violence Prevention Center at Binghamton University. And I took an interest in that particular internship because it would give me exposure to clinical skills, which is at the time what I thought I wanted to pursue as a profession, clinical psychology. And it was an environment where those particular services would be provided to Binghamton University students that were victims of stalking, harassment, assault. And it was very new territory for me. At that time, I hadn't yet become familiar in depth with those kind of issues, but I was interested in learning and really building awareness around those issues to make myself a better asset in the clinical community. And the internship itself, I mean, there were moments where literally a young woman could walk into that space just crying her eyes out. And I literally just had to turn the other way, go to my cubicle, do what I need to do. But I developed an awareness of just different situations that would affect different women, not even just Black women, but just different women on campus. And it was kind of shocking to me because I would just never think that just underneath the surface level party culture and just like the smiles and the campus mascot and just all these things that I just, all the normalcy of college life that I was taking for granted, I would never think that there were just so many people like looking for a space to disclose like these really like messed up situations that they were in and these really messed up things that had happened to them. But I learned a lot about consent, the nuances around consent. And just as a Black man, I also had my own awareness of how I and my friends and just other people who look like me think about consent, hip hop, and how consent and harassment exists in hip hop. And it just slowly started to like avalanche. But I just felt like this is something that's actually, it doesn't just affect my community, but it's definitely affecting my community in a very deep, but not talked about enough type of way. And it made a lot of sense to incorporate it into this larger theme of police brutality is so important, but what about this? This is also getting a lot of attention, but what about that? And I really credit that internship for planting those seeds of just how a lot of those stories go undisclosed.
Thank you. Because, yeah, in addition to the police brutality and the social justice and the sexual assault, you also touch on colorism. You talk about religion and spirituality a little bit. And there are just these different threads that I think all make up the Black community that you interweave into your narrative. One of those being that sometimes we are tools of our own oppression. And there's a conversation between Farrah and Kendra where Farrah's not really wanting to pursue the allegations of sexual assault that are swirling around the campus, even though she heard about them. And there's another scene where there's a Black officer who ends up arresting a professor who leads a protest. Why did you want to show that other side of the Black community as well?
Because it exists and it's real. There's so many times where I've walked into a corner store and I'll see, you know, the white guy in the suit when he purchases his, you know, Poland Spring or whatever, his sandwich, the the person of color behind the register will drop the change in his hand. And I've seen how that same person of color behind the register will smack my change on the counter and expect me to just pick it up. And, you know, I'm gonna pick it up because it's my change, but I make that mental note, like, okay, they're at times, even if someone is not necessarily being a tool of their own oppression or necessarily being a deliberate tool of my oppression, even as a person of color, you can still adopt that lens and a certain lens that some white people wear when they look at people of color.
And do it's the really, work it's of really white supremacy for happens. Them.
Right.
Okay. So we got to talk about your problematic character.
Okay.
Samson. So you already know. You already know. You're smiling. So you already know he's hella problematic. We got to talk about, I mean, and yes, he is, I guess, the villain, and he is responsible for the most incendiary of inciting incidents. But like what was kind of ha-ha funny in like the first couple of pages becomes very disturbing as the novel goes on. How did you embody this character to write him as complex as he was, even in though he was a villain? Like there was still, I feel like there was still deliberate thought process and complexity to him, even in him being problematic and just very difficult to deal with in the read.
I really appreciate your analysis of Samson. I didn't want to write him as this obvious, in-your-face, problematic character at the onset. Mm. The way that Samson appears at first, kind of to your point, was humor, jokes. Oh, he has a smart mouth. And a lot of people don't realize that, like, jokes are a really good way to get to know certain people, or at least the person who's telling them. You know, you'll have people who tell jokes about themselves, like they get on themselves a lot. You'll have people who crack jokes about women. So I felt like humor would be a great vehicle for people to gradually get to know the person that they're dealing with. And yeah, writing him was challenging. I didn't necessarily think about justifying the negative impact that he had on other characters in the story or justifying his negative behaviors. But I wanted to humanize him the same way that I humanized every other character in the book. And so he had to have a family backstory. He had to have a particular upbringing. And it wasn't to say that if you have this upbringing and this family background and you are 9 times out of 10 going to behave in this way and it's going to be okay and understandable. But more so, I still wanted him to be rich, and I still wanted his character to be picked apart. And I wanted people to ask certain questions around, well, how does growing up in this kind of community and growing up in this type of household impact the way you see women? It doesn't make it right. And it doesn't mean that it's an automatic truth that that's the way it's supposed to be. But I wrote him to provoke questions the same way that I wrote other characters in the book to provoke questions.
And so in provoking those questions and leaving the book kind of on a cliffhanger, like it all comes together, but it's like it's still unsettled. Is there a sequel to follow They Were Chosen that you're now working on? Because I was like, okay, oh, that's the last page? Wait, I feel like I want some more resolution here. So what's next for you, Shola?
So I want to start off with resolution, and then I'm gonna get on what's next. We're going to flip it a little bit, but I got okay. you. So I was very intentional about how I ended the story, not only with the intent of writing a cliffhanger, but I really wanted to drive home the fact that a lot of instances of sexual assault do go undisclosed. And the additional fact that a lot of instances that do go disclosed don't ultimately lead to what justice looks like for the victim. Mm-hmm. So it was bittersweet. ending the book the way I chose to end it. In terms of a sequel, I originally wrote this book with the intention of writing a sequel. But I also started writing this book as a young adult. I was 21 when I finished the first draft. Throughout the 7 years of writing the book, I've become like so much more entrenched in adult life. Capitalism is capitalisming. You know what I'm saying? Uh-huh. And I would still love to write a sequel and give people a part two, but I created a deal with myself saying that if I can connect with at least 1,000 readers, I will seriously entertain the process of beginning to write a part two. But if there's a few people here and there, and granted, I'm really grateful for the readership that I'm starting to accumulate, but 1,000 readers would really make me feel like there's at least 1,000 people who are going to have a problem with me if I don't write a part two. You know what I mean?
I'm all fine with goals and standards. Set them high. I'm just going to pass along the things that I've heard from other writers that, you know, if your readers ask you for a sequel, give them one.
I appreciate it.
I want to switch to my speed round and a little game before I let you go for the afternoon. What is your favorite book?
I would say Slap Boxing with Jesus by Victor LaValle.
Who is your favorite author?
My favorite author. I don't think I have a favorite author. Every author that I've read has inspired me in a different way or has humored me in a different way. And just looking back at just all the different types of books that I read, even from sci-fi, historical fiction, there's so much to appreciate from each and every one of them that it would be so hard to just isolate one as a favorite.
Okay. You mentioned how influential media was to your writing process. So what is your favorite TV show?
I'll go with The Wire.
Name three things on your bucket list.
Skydiving is one. I got to do it. I got to do it while I'm alive.
Okay.
It's just one of those things. That rush that I feel like is one of those things you do it and it's like you can only talk about it and really understand it if you do it. And it just looks like one of the scariest things I could do in life. I haven't been to Europe yet. I haven't been to Europe yet. And I'm trying to change that in 2023. So hopefully book a trip to Barcelona or one of the other cities that I'm really interested in visiting in Europe. And a third.
Writing another book. It doesn't have to be
a sequel.
Another book. It doesn't have to be a sequel. It could just be another book.
I'm not opposed to that. I think for the rest of this year, the thought of writing another book is like,
it's too fresh. it's too fresh. I know.
but definitely want to write another book. I would really like to write a collection of poems, which I literally have a bunch of titles for it. I think you'd be amused by all the different titles. That could be a collection of poems and essays or a children's book. I'd really want to publish one of those two types of books.
So with that said, from the famous line from Love Jones, what author makes you want to burn your notebook?
Love Jones is actually one of my top five favorite movies because I love how well it's shot and I appreciate the pace of how the story is written. Like it's not a fast paced like love story. Like it has its slow moments that are slow and like I feel like I'm really in the scenes with Darius. But what author wants to make me burn my work? I mean, I don't know because burn is so dramatic. If there was an author that made me want to like pick up the pen and go a little harder, it might be Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Okay,
that man he's a beast. He is phenomenal at what he does. He's a prolific writer, and I admire his style. And he's definitely someone that if he read They Were Chosen, it was just like, I think you could dig a little deeper here. Why did you graze the surface on this issue? Have you thought about? And I would really take his criticism.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And so my game is called Rewriting the Classics. Name one book you wish you would have written.
Perhaps 8 Years in Power by Ta-Nehisi Coates.
Name a book where you want to change the ending and how would you do it?
I would change the end of Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire. And the reason why I would change it is because there was a really like remarkable, honorable male student at Hogwarts who had performed in the, it was like a, they do this event almost every 3 to 4 years. And he was like a top select, like everyone thought he was going to like win and everything. he was a great guy. And he who must not be named killed him. And it was kind of, I remember it being like a wrong place, wrong time kind of situation for anybody who's, who grew up on Harry Potter. But I remember reading that. I think I was probably like 14 or 13. And I was just like, they didn't have to do my man like that. Like, he didn't have to die. Like, you know, like they didn't have to, I was messed up. I would have tweaked that part of the ending a little bit, personally.
Okay. And then name a book that you think is overrated and why.
I'll be honest, and this is not even me trying to be politically correct. I haven't read a book that I thought, that I personally thought was overrated. Yeah, I think I've heard of movies and shows, or may have watched certain things and felt like, oh, okay, this is not as cracked up as what people make it to be. But anything that I took the time to read, I never really felt was overrated.
All right, so then my final question for you today is, when you are dead and gone and among the ancestors, what would you like someone to write about the words and the work that you've left behind?
I would want people to remember my work for being thought-provoking. I would want people to start and continue very important conversations about what it means to be Black in America, what it means to be an adult, what it means to be an advocate and to care about others, and what it means to encompass all those things, and how just the underlying conflicts that may exist between some of those things at different times under particular circumstances. I would want people to remember my work for making them uncomfortable in a productive way, and for unpacking each of those themes.
Thank you, Shola.
Thank you.
Big thank you to Shola Benmi for being here today on Black and Published. Make sure you check out Shola's debut novel, They Were Chosen, out now from Vision Speaks NYC. And if you're not following Shola, follow him on the socials. He's at Vision Speaks on Instagram. That's our show for the week. If you liked this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's BLK and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Shola about his research to write his half-Nigerian, half-Jamaican main character. Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments. I'll holla at y'all next week when our guests will be Wamika Bingham Risher, author of Soul Culture, Black Poets, Books, and Questions That Grew Me Up.
Every idea that I threw out that I thought was kind of crazy, I thought, man, they let me do this, and I'm really just going to do whatever I want, right? So one of the things was the title was a little bit different. They wanted us to come up with something. I said, oh, I'm going to send them back something real Black and real Southern. I'm going to say Soul Culture, Black Poets, Books, and Questions That Grew Me Up. If they let me put that on a book cover, then I'm going to write whatever I want, right? And they said, love that. Lean into that. And
more,
so,
please.
Yes, more please.
That's next week on Black and Published. I'll holler at y'all then. Peace.